runasradio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Nguyen announcing show number 284 with guest Mario Heward, recorded Monday, September 10th, 2012. Run As Radio is produced each week by TWOP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. If you're listening to this on a day we published, I'm already on the road. Yes, I'm part of the crazy traveling .NET Rocks Run As Radio, the tablet show road trip, going across the U.S. twice, because once is not enough. And I hope you'll come out and see us. We're doing some talks on DevOps, some of the new Win 8 things, talking about Visual Studio 2012. And you can learn all about the road trip at .NETRocks.com/roadtrip.aspx. Today's show is not about the road trip at all. It's actually talking to Mario Heward. And Mario is the author of Advanced Windows Debugging and Advanced .NET Debugging. He has 13 years at Microsoft, and he's worked in the development of Windows, starting with Windows 98 up to Windows Vista. With the advent of cloud computing, Mario has worked in the SaaS arena and delivered the asset inventory service, as well as leading a team of developers building the core platform for the next generation of Microsoft Online Management Service, Windows Intune. Most recently, Mario has worked as a dedicated developer premier field engineer, helping ensure that customers build their solutions on the Microsoft stack in the most efficient and reliable way possible. Mario lives in Washington State with his wife, daughter, and two dogs. Welcome, sir.
Great. Thank you, Richard.
You have a really interesting career. I mean, you stayed in Microsoft through all this, but you've really ducked and wove through the company.
I started my career as a software test engineer in development. That's kind of where I started getting my passion around debugging and then Windows .NET internals. And I was working on the big beefy server systems for a while, and then I did a complete switcheroo and went over to Windows Mobile for a bit, you know, all in kind of software development arena.
Sure.
And then I decided, you know what, I want to go and work with customers directly, so I went into Microsoft Premier Field Engineering.
Well, and the PFEs are, I think, one of the unsung heroes of Microsoft. They've certainly been favorite guests of mine on Run As Radio, just because you're the guys out in the field working on the hard problems and really getting some real insight on how Microsoft products should be used.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's a great experience because, like you mentioned, we get to see a lot of very interesting problems out there and kind of have to take a creative approaches in how to fix them and then also kind of feed that back into the product groups, right? So that we can make, decisions or better decisions based on that moving forward.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the challenges is that hopefully the PFEs get enough time to really talk to the product groups about how things behave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
The thing that's interesting to me also is this idea of advanced window debugging or Windows debugging in general being something that an IT person needs to know about. Isn't that a programmer's role?
Well, that's an interesting question. I tend to view debug. Unfortunately, when we say debugging, a lot of people think of developers sitting in his office, grokking through the code, and is like, I've got some weird, I don't know, WCF proxy issue, whatever. Code specific.
Sure.
For me, debugging, and that's kind of how I got started in the area, was all about not necessarily debugging application faults, but it was about understanding the abstraction that the application was sitting on top of, which happened to be, Windows in the case of native code or .NET CLR in the case of managed code.
Sure.
Right? So kind of digging into it and really understanding the fundamentals of the system, which then translates into not just fixing my own bugs, because I have plenty of them, but also kind of in general, understanding the system. And that can really help me solve different types of problems.
So when we're talking about instability of machines in the workplace, this often comes down to an issue inside of Windows in one respect or another.
I mean, I was working an issue not long ago where there was this application and it was kind of started misbehaving. And it turned out there was nothing wrong with the application itself. It surfaced in the application as kind of this weird, little exception that says I can't load this particular assembly. Turned out there was an antivirus running on the machine that would periodically lock that file.
Huh.
Right? And so application was perfectly fine, but there was some other part of the system that caused the application to fail.
Well, and in a way you could have said, well, that program should have been tolerant to the idea that its DLL could occasionally be locked.
Absolutely, yeah.
But, you know, these are just inter-application interactions, and they go on all the time. You know, the other thing that amused me as soon as you said it was how much we anthropomorphize software. The idea of a program misbehaving is just fascinating to me. We all do it. You know, we're almost giving a sense of intent to software. But I certainly, my work in the IT space has been, you have particular combinations of software that are just grumpy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the machine's never quite right. And you get to a point where you almost, it's not like you can point at any one thing. You just smell, something's not right about this machine.
Yep. And I think it's gotten, over the years, we add kind of more and more abstractions to make it easier for applications to be developed and things like that. So it's a lot of difference from how we develop software today and obviously 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become more of a kind of integration exercise almost between all these different abstractions that exist on the machines today versus me sitting down and writing this very isolated, you know, command line application that doesn't talk to anything but itself, right?
Right.
And in those cases, that becomes very tricky to do efficient root cause analysis of debugging.
And it does need us to understand higher up in the stack. I never hesitated to, you know, be very familiar with the BIOS level calls of MS-DOS. And I mean, that was just part of
the good old days, huh?
Oh, yeah. What was it? 62 commands total?
Yeah.
You know, you could actually you can not only remember them all, you can remember the parameter lists of them all. And I think I lost count in Windows when it went over 20,000.
Yeah. Obviously, there's benefits to having these high-level abstractions. Mm-hmm. Because we don't have to worry about all the different types of hardware that we're running on, because that's all kind of abstracted. But there was also some interesting side effects of that.
Yeah, and we kind of need to know. And I see now you're just making me go down. Remember when we had to figure out what IRQs we wanted everything assigned to?
I started my days like when I started doing this was years and years ago, but we were doing I was not working professionally because I was young at that point, mm-hmm. but we were doing a lot of graphics programming. And back then, it was all assembly and writing directly to video buffers.
Sure.
Craziness like that. And those are the days now where I'm like, well, I'm glad I have that abstraction sitting between me because I don't have to write different code for 40 different graphics adapters, right?
Right. Or just figuring out the particular printer I could buy for this combination of software because each one of them provided its own set of drivers.
Like, mm-hmm.
Let's face it, Windows did some good stuff for us
mm-hmm.
And still does. We just have to now figure out when it doesn't interact well. So maybe we need to go down this chain. As an IT person, when I've got a machine that's misbehaving like that, your scenario you just painted is a wonderful one. So this app, which functioned just fine, now it's occasionally barfing this error. It's irregular. How do you get started trying to diagnose something like that?
Well, I would start out, you know, I'm looking at the app itself, kind of making the assumption that the app itself has caused the problem to happen, right?
Okay. So there is some action on the part of this software that's getting this error that is generating the error. It's not
that's
just
correct.
Being spiked from the outside in the world.
Mm-hmm. And typically, it depends a little bit whether or not I'm encountering or whether or not I'm debugging this problem in a production environment or if there is like a separate test environment, right? Because mm-hmm. that dictates a little bit which tools I can actually use.
Right.
So in this case, it happened to be a production environment. And when it comes to investigating the application itself, since I can't really attach a live debugger, I usually ask, but I am always sort of, I usually hear these chuckles on the other end of the line mm-hmm. saying, you know, we can't install live debuggers, obviously, because if I attach a debugger to a process that's in production, that process stops, basically, and it won't service requests.
Okay, that's not good.
That's not good, right? Because then we're talking about downtime, and people don't usually like downtime.
And strapping a debugger on literally isolated, I figured just slow it down, but you're saying, no, it won't run at all anymore.
No, it will actually suspend it, right?
Right.
It can run periodically, right? Mm-hmm. When I attach the debugger, it's going to suspend all the threads in the process.
Okay.
Because the debugger is sitting there, you know, you got that cursor blinking saying, tell me what you want to do. At that point, it's suspended.
Right.
And I'll do some investigations. Maybe I'll look at some data structures or things like that, right? And
now, then this debugger, where do I get a copy?
So you can get, for the production level problems, we typically employ a debugging package called Debugging Tools for Windows. The package is free of charge. It comes with the Windows SDK.
Oh, okay, so it's in the Windows SDK.
Yep.
Yet another great tool people often don't know about.
Yeah, absolutely. And these debuggers are kind of a double-edged sword because they're immensely powerful debuggers.
Mm-hmm.
Really, like, I mean, you can dig down into a system in really, really deep depth. However, the learning curve for them are a little bit steep. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's pretty much command line, really kind of weird looking commands that you got to kind of remember, and learning curve is pretty steep.
Okay. So you're going to have that, I popped open the hood and looked inside and okay.
Yep. So I've looked in there and the process, like I mentioned, it's suspended at this point. So nothing, it can't service anything. Now, if I choose to like go in and set a couple of breakpoints, for example, and then I tell the debugger to resume execution, well, in that case, the process continues running, right? But only until it hits that breakpoint. So in general, live debugging in production, bad thing.
Yeah.
It means downtime, right?
Yes.
So then what we usually resort to is what's known as post-mortem debugging. And that is really just taking a snapshot of the process that's faulting. And by snapshot, I mean there are X number of tools that you can use to generate these snapshots.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, the tool just goes in, opens up that process, reads all the memory, and dumps it out on disk.
Okay, makes a copy of it. Isn't this IntelliTrace now?
It's similar,
okay.
Because IntelliTrace kind of does the same thing. It kind of, you know, attaches itself to the process. You run some stuff, and it records what the process is doing, and then you can take that resulting file and then load it up into Visual Studio. And you really kind of have a historical debugging feature there,
mm-hmm.
because you can go to the fault, and sometimes, you know, faults depend on what happened earlier. Well, with IntelliTrace, you can now go backwards in time.
Wow.
Which is a really pretty awesome feature. It certainly helps you a lot from going from a static snapshot saying, here's the problem right now, and you manually having to backtrack through it.
Right.
But with the dumps themselves, which is what we call these static snapshots, crash dumps, they get generated using a particular tool, and then we take them off the production servers and get them locally on a machine, and then I'll use this debugging tools for Windows to open up the crash dump, and then I can sort of introspect on the state of the process and try to formulate theories on why it ended up in that state.
Hmm.
So that's the most common way if you want to look at any given process. But if we kind of tie that back to the issue of the antivirus lock in the file, there wasn't anything in this crash dump that was telling me that the app itself had done it or was the cause of it, right?
Right.
And then you can start creating kind of theories around it. One other interesting data point in this particular example was the file that I was trying to open was a DLL that was critical for this app to function.
Right.
Yet the app had functioned for a bit, and it only at random intervals starts failing with this load problem.
Exactly. And are you able to see that it was trying to load the file? Like, what does that look like in the debugger?
So that's a good question. Most commonly, a .NET application will surface errors through exceptions. And exceptions are really nothing but first class types in .NET.
Mm-hmm.
So if I wanted to throw a file not found exception, I would new up an instance of that and raise it, right?
Right.
Well, that instance goes on the managed heap. So it's in memory somewhere. And when I load this dump file, I can use some commands that will allow me to dump out all the exceptions that are on the managed heap. And that gives me an idea of what's possibly happen in the process.
So even though that error didn't necessarily surface as a dialogue or even something pushed to the Windows event log, it is in the snapshot, so you should be able to find it there.
It might be in the snapshot. Okay. And the reason why I say might is because once this exception has been thrown,
mm-hmm.
And that instance of the exception is on the managed heap, well, the garbage collector is free to go and collect that instance if it's not being used anymore.
Okay.
But usually if you have a problem where an exception is being thrown, and especially if it's been thrown a number of times, the fact that you're seeing a lot of these traces tells you at a minimum it's been thrown X number of times.
Right.
But probably more than that.
Well, and of course, now our tendency to keep retrying things to see if it'll behave differently actually serves you here, because it pollutes the trace enough that you're not going to miss, hey, this thing's been called over and over and over again.
Yeah, exactly.
That's funny.
And we see, you know, some people make attempts to catch exceptions and recover from exceptions. Sometimes there's just, it's very interesting patterns, right? Mm-hmm. I have a memory exception. Well, I'm going to retry it 10 times.
Right.
Is that, you know, are you going to regain memory in those 10 times? It's kind of...
Yeah, especially if you just did it across a couple of ticks each, right? It's like, exactly. All right, in a fraction of a second, I tried this 10 times and it didn't work for any of them. Isn't that amazing? Because, you know, you're talking about managed memory space, and in managed space, sometimes memory does get freed up if you give it a little time.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is kind of an example of also where you have understanding that the garbage, you know, kind of how the garbage collector works.
Mm-hmm.
Is an important part of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, when we think about, you don't need to be a programmer.
Yeah.
To need to know how this whole concept of managed memory mm-hmm. works, because it's fairly important to the behavior of, say, these days for me, it's the web servers.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I've seen these panic GCs run and literally stop everything for a minute. Just paralyze a web server because that machine's got 4 gigs of RAM in it and the heap was completely packed and you've got a ton of in-state session, and then this is what happens when you get to that state.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another great, great example of that is, for example, say I wrote this application that invoked, you know, through COM interop or what have you,
mm-hmm.
the media player COM control, right?
Yep.
Well, I've seen cases where code has been written such that that instance of the media player was being defined as a static, for example.
Hmm.
And they load up the 300 meg media file, play it, and of course, 300 megs is going to be somewhere in memory. Hmm. And then the question is, well, I'm not using it anymore, and the garbage collector should clean it up, right?
Yes.
Well, it's a static, right? So it's always going to be in scope. It's never going to get cleaned up.
Yeah.
And so those are kind of the interesting ways in which we have to understand the abstraction we're working with.
Sure.
Otherwise, we run the risk of kind of coding ourselves in a corner.
I mean, that's a genuine bug there. That just shouldn't be declared as a static. But it doesn't also mean we can fix it either.
Mm-hmm.
The real fix is to make it not a static anymore. But
you
can't necessarily do that. So I want to jump back to the scenario you're working through. So you had this repeated failure to try and load this DLL, but it didn't fail every time either, right?
Nope. I mean,
you knew this DLL is absolutely a requirement for this app. This app, if this DLL was not available, this app shouldn't run at all, and it's running. So clearly this is an intermittent problem. Sometimes it's available, sometimes it isn't.
Yeah. So from kind of the crash dump, right, or the post-mortem debugging,
mm-hmm.
I made a decision there to basically say I'm going to focus on things that could affect this process outside of itself.
Right. Something's affecting this DLL
mm-hmm.
that isn't the app.
Yeah. And then the next step is, what diagnostics tool should I use
mm-hmm.
to try to figure out what's happening there?
So are you thinking in terms of, I want to just watch what happens with this DLL over some time?
Right. So what I wanted to do is basically say I know that it can't be loaded,
mm-hmm.
and it's intermittent. So I need some sort of a tool that might help me figure out, why that is. And there were a couple of options there.
Mm-hmm.
First one, again, this kind of boils down to knowing a little bit about the internals.
Mm-hmm.
.NET has a way to trace. You can tell that the loader of .NET, which is the one that's responsible for loading assemblies, to give you more in-depth data about the loading process.
Okay.
So that was one option. And the second option, of course, is also the beautiful sysinternals tools by, that Mark Rustonovich wrote. And he's got one there that comes in useful over and over again in his process monitor.
Right. I didn't think we could get through this conversation without talking about process monitor at some point.
Now, it is. I mean, the tools in general, the sysinternals tools, are extremely, extremely valuable. Mm. And process monitor is, it's used all the time. Actually, one of the things I think that Mark tells people all the time is, when in doubt, use process monitor.
Right.
That's sort of his little mantra. But
the challenge I have with process monitor in this particular scenario is you tend to want to monitor top down, and in this case, this is a DLL, right? You're trying to see who else might be manipulating this DLL. Can you actually get process monitor to do that for you?
Well, the approach I took was let's run process monitor on the app itself.
Okay.
Right? Because the exception that was surfaced was really just, hey, I can't load anything, or I can't load the DLL. It didn't give me any data in as far as, give me some clues as to why, right?
Yeah.
And so running process monitor against this process, where process monitor will hook into certain things that are happening in the process,
mm-hmm.
and can tell me maybe a little bit more information about why. And so in the case of this DLL load failure, it turned out the process monitor was able to give me a little bit of additional data, which basically said that a file is locked, basically, during the times when the problems were happening.
So you threw a process monitor on the app that was failing and now got a chance to see it attempted to load that DLL. The DLL was locked.
Yeah.
Now you knew why the error was occurring. And I mean, this is a classic problem, too. The developer never considered the idea that this might be an issue. So there's no handle for it. There's no descriptions for it. It just fails.
Yeah, yeah. And the fact that it's intermittent, that's
right.
The worst part of any problem.
It's terrible.
Intermittency on it. So, and from there, you still kind of have that final step that you have to take.
Mm-hmm.
You've gone from something is failing to an assembly can't be loaded to assembly can't be loaded because it's locked.
Locked. Now, who's locking it?
Who's locking it?
Why is this locked?
And for that particular part, I didn't actually use any other type of diagnostics tool.
Mm-hmm.
Just brainstorming and thinking through things, and also talking to the owning developers for that app, and it turned out it was a very isolated app, so you didn't have a lot of, it wasn't making 30 different web service calls or anything crazy like that. Made me start kind of thinking about, all right, well, what else is running on this machine that could do that? And antivirus was kind of the first thing that popped into my head.
Okay. I mean, it's a fair assumption point, just from experience perspective. You say irregular locking of files. Are we running any virus?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's not an outrageous leap either, but it is an interesting challenge to say, how do I watch a DLL and mm-hmm. see who else is touching it?
Yep, and how they're doing it. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Especially in the context of, this is a DLL owned by this app. Nothing else should be touching it. It was a reasonable assumption.
It's sitting in the website's private folder. And
right.
It's either the app or something else like an antivirus that's supposed to be touching it. Or if that's not the case, you've got something really, really bizarre going on.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Something really nasty.
But a lot of the times, the diagnostics kind of overall, the way I like to explain how I think about it anyway, is that the diagnostics process is usually, it's kind of like a big decision tree, right?
Mm-hmm.
You start with this high-level problem. Something is not working. And then you kind of look at some things, whether that be using a debugger or process monitor or some other tool, and that gets you a little closer. So you start creating some theories about what could have led up to that. And those theories become subnodes of this overall problem.
Right.
For each of those, you start creating other theories, etc., and eventually you end up with this one big decision tree, where most of the paths down that tree is going to they're going to be dead ends.
Yep.
But one of those paths will take you to a root cause, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair. Interesting squad of problems there, just trying to come at it. The other thing I found when I'm looking at unstable machines is bad video drivers.
Mm.
But that tends to be a tough one to prove. But it's like if the video drivers are bad, lots of stuff go poorly for that machine. It's not a happy machine. So when I see a generally unstable machine, it's one of the places I look. But just upgrading a video driver is, I think, a cop-out. Like, how do you actually diagnose we've got a bad video driver here?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I haven't done a lot of video driver debugging per se. Mm-hmm. Usually what ends up happening is it fails to the point where there is a bug check.
Right.
Right. And the tougher problems is obviously some weird things are happening on the screen, but the ones I usually deal with is a bug check, right? And then you load up the dump file. You take a look at what the bug check is. And usually you get a call stack where you can see that driver, right? Who's kind of causing it. And from there, that's usually kind of where I stop. And the recommendation there is, well, go and see if there are new drivers available. Obviously, if it's a Microsoft driver, we'll debug it in depth, right? And try to get final root cause.
Well, and this rocks all the way back to your role in Windows Intune, because these days on a modern OS, Win 7, if you actually get a machine to blue screen because a driver gets in a stupid state, mm-hmm. when that machine comes back up, it's Windows 7 that's saying to you, hey, this looks like it was caused by the video driver. We should go look for an update.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's way friendlier than, say, going back to the XP world where, okay, you blue screened. I hope you read that. Do you know how to deal with a dump file?
Yeah, exactly. Here's a link to the kernel debugger.
Yeah, have a good time.
Yeah, no, it's true. It took a much better approach to a common set of problems,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. True
Which
enough.
Is that of drivers. So, and they,
Do we really need to learn how to dig into our blue screen dump files these days? Like, do you feel like the current OS is, you don't need to go there?
I'm not going to say that you'll never have to do it. For driver developers, obviously, that's a good skill to have because mm-hmm. they're going to need to figure those things out. But as a general, from an admin's point of view, it's gotten a lot better.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of the times the recommendations that you get are, well, you should see if there's an upgrade to the driver. And as far as having to actually fire up a kernel debugger or look at those stop codes, it's a lot less nowadays.
Pretty rare. One of the evilest problems I had was one of my own personal machines that I had hand-built, so it's entirely my fault, and I had a defective power plug on the C drive.
Wow.
And so how did this manifest? Every so often, typically when the machine got really, really warm, the machine would blue screen and then wouldn't power back up. But if I waited a little while, when I powered it back up, it was fine. So now I'm looking for stuff that's overheating. And it took a long time and basically luck to figure out, oh, this power plug isn't proper. It was a SATA power plug, wasn't properly locking onto the drive. And so it just would get just left loose that the power would be cut to the drive. And so it turns out Windows gets really sulky if it can't reach its C drive. That makes it sad.
Yeah.
That, wow, just so you know, the crazy, the error messages and the events that you're receiving were so far removed from the problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's something physical like that.
Well, that isn't it. That's an interesting debug session. That takes you all the way from why is it randomly kind of failing or blue screening all the way down to the metal.
Right. And it comes out, it's a bad note. None of this hardware is defective. It all tests separately. It's fine. But this particular assembly, and it's really evil when you have defective plugs,
because
mm-hmm. They're just not something you normally look at or think about. They hide from you.
Yeah, and hardware failures tend to be, one of the harder ones to debug. Another example is if you have bad memory.
Yeah.
That makes for a really interesting debug session when an application is allocating some memory and, of course, some bits get flipped somewhere because of bad hardware and nothing you see when you're looking at that process makes any sense, and no theories in that big decision tree actually goes down to root cause, right? So those get tricky.
Well, when the material you're trying to reference to diagnose the problem is the problem,
right?
You are kind of trapped.
Mm-hmm. Luckily, that you know those aren't. I think over the years, with, at least when it comes to like bad memory, I think I've only seen it like once. That was a long, long time
ago. Yeah, it is relatively rare. And these days, I think the hardware is better at diagnosing itself. That if you have bad memory, you'll pretty quickly get a BIOS level. This is bad memory warning.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I think the hard and generally speaking, hardware's never been more reliable than it is right now. I think.
Yeah.
You know, we don't talk about server hardware server failures very often anymore. They just don't happen that much.
Yeah.
But software's more and more complicated, and that's the thing that we got to spend more time on. Well, Mario, any other things folks should be looking at if they want to get better at debugging? Because I do see it as a valuable skill in the field.
Yeah, well, what I try to tell engineers when they ask me, you know, how do I become an expert at debugging or how do I get better at it? Usually what I try to emphasize is not so much, you know, don't worry about learning the debugger if that's the diagnostics tool you're using. Don't worry about learning it like inside and out.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, focus on learning about the abstractions that are being used. So if you're writing managed code, you know, look at the garbage collector, for example, and at least at a high level, figure out how it works, you know, and what are some of the pitfalls from that your application could get into. And if you're writing native code, you will learn about some of the other abstractions we have, like the heap manager or, you know, com, decom, whatever the case may be. But learning the internals is kind of the tricky part, but that's also the most important part.
Right.
Because the debuggers themselves, when you run them, and let's say that you had looked at the reference manual and it said, to get heap information, you run the bang heap command. Well, you can do that. That's easy enough. But the data that comes out of that command really requires you to understand how the heap is structured in order to make sense out of it.
Sure.
So the internals part of it is, in my opinion, really the most important part. And then the debuggers themselves, well, they're easy. Yes, you have to memorize a few really oddly named commands sometimes, mm-hmm. but, you know, that's easy.
Yeah.
It's the internals that
that's reference material in the end. The tougher one is actually making sense of what you're seeing. Mario, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. Great time.
You bet. And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.